About Israel and some of the controversies surrounding Israel and modern Israel and Israeli culture. And believe it or not, the Hebrew language, Ivrit, the Hebrew language, is for completely different reasons an extremely, extremely controversial language. For two opposite extreme reasons, the Hebrew language of Ivrit is something that is very, very controversial. And I would like to tell you an embarrassing story, which was my introduction to this controversy. So, you know, like I grew up, like most of you, I grew up modern Orthodox in a modern Orthodox school where we had Ivrit class and, you know, where we learned to go to the Beit Shimush. Did anybody learn that?
Yeah.
For the bathrooms? Ani tzaricha da Beit Shimush bevakasha, whatever. We learned the most, you know, backwards Hebrew. Anyway, we learned Hebrew. And we celebrated Yom HaAtzmaut. I remember as, little kids, when we were mamish, little kids, and there was a whole bunch of classrooms on a hallway, and every year Yom HaAtzmaut, everybody was so excited and looked forward because we turned the hallway into an airplane. We put all the things in the thing, and every classroom was like a different place in Israel, and we got falafel, and whatever.
So cute.
It was a big, big part of my upbringing and my life, and certainly learning Hebrew and Ivrit was considered to be a very Jewish thing, very religious thing. Like the guys who were like really advanced in high school, they went to like the Ivrit yeshivas, like Bush or KBY, or what I'm saying? So that's how I grew up, with a very, very, positive association and religiously positive association with Hebrew and the Hebrew language. Okay, so now fast forward a couple of years, 20, 21 years old or so, 21, 22, I'm married, and I am about to go for my smicha test, my bechina, my test in smicha. Now, I got smicha from a person that probably you've never heard of, so I printed out this page over here, so you could see, but his name is Rav Yecheskel Roth. Rav Yecheskel Roth. This is the person who I got smicha from, sat across from him. It was very, very, very intimidating.
That's scary.
Really? For real? This this one?
I'm pretty sure the
Jewish Yahtzee.
Okay, we'll talk after. Yeah, one second.
Rav Yecheskel Roth.
Judy
Roth.
Okay.
Oh, right. Right, Taka.
Taka.
Schwartz is Roth?
Schwartz.
You're related to Judy?
No!
I didn't know that.
No,
I got it. I mean, Roth and Schwartz are like the two most common Jewish names, It's like other than Cohen and okay. So now look, so this man, Rav Yecheskel Roth, is a tzaddik. Now I say a tzaddik, I mean a tzaddik, like an angelic person, like a malach. I can tell you all sorts of stories about him. Lamaisa, Rav Yecheskel Roth, every year, still right now, is in Meron. He comes every year, not just for like Lag BaOmer, but like for a month before and a month after. I don't know, he spends like months in Meron, doing his thing over there. He's a very, 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 holy, very, very serious tzaddik. I'll tell you a story that I heard firsthand. Okay, I'll tell you, how did I get to this person? Because I have nothing to do with Satmar. He's a Satmar posting. He's a Satmar post, which we're going to talk about in a minute. I have nothing to do with Satmar. However, I learned in a Bukhari yeshiva in Queens. Yeah. Yes. After Ohel Simcha, after I got married, I learned for a couple of years in Or HaChaim. That's where Rabbi Fix and I were chavrusas, and we learned there together, Or HaChaim in Queens. However, at that time, Or HaChaim was not in the very big building, if you know what I'm talking about, but at that time, they were in the basement of Ohel Simcha. So when we were there at Ohel Simcha, I got to know Rav Chaimov. Rav Yigal Chaimov is a person I consider to be one of my Rebbeim, a Rebbe of mine, a person I have a very close relationship with for many years. He taught me a tremendous amount of Torah. And so Rav Chaimov and I became very close, and I ended up learning in his yeshiva and teaching in his yeshiva. When I was there is when I went to go get smicha, right? Now, what smicha means is different for different people, right? But basically what it means is you are taking a test on a certain amount of information, on a certain section of halacha, usually involves kashrus of some form or another. In my test, it was kashrus and also taharas mishpacha, hilchos nida, and all of that that we were tested on together. Okay, so I went to him for my test, and it was an oral test. It was over like 2 or 3 days. I went back and forth. So I go into Bar Park, and I go up into his office, and I sitting down, across the table from him, and Now, I don't speak a word of Yiddish. Well, that's not true. I speak a couple of words of Yiddish, you know, like schmutz, you know, vach, right? Yeah, that kind of thing. So I speak no Yiddish, right? And so I said in the following, okay, and this is my embarrassing introduction to this whole topic, this controversial topic, which I didn't know was controversial. So I said to him, efshar bi'ivrit, like I said, like that, like, you know, because here I could speak Hebrew-ish, you know. So I said, efshar bi'ivrit. And he like went like this. He went. said Balashan Akodesh. That's what he said to me. Balashan Akodesh. And I said okay. So and then I had the conversation with him, you know, and I had the test and I got my smicha, whatever. Not that day, whatever. And, but I was confused from that conversation. I was confused from that conversation because like, what? Like, what do you mean? Like, you know, here I wanted to talk in Hebrew, and he said, no, talk in Hebrew. So I was like, what's the difference? The difference is with a tough or a suff. Is the difference if I say, you know, oi or o? Like, I'm not joking. I really did not understand what he meant by that. Like, you know, like, I don't speak Hebrew. I speak Lashon HaKodesh. And then I was like, well, I mean, like, what about all the Svarim that were written? Like, can't he read the Rambam? Like, the Rambam's in Hebrew. Right? You know what I mean? So I was very, very confused by this. And the truth is, I really didn't do anything with it at the time. I just remember that it was like confusing to me, and I felt strange and funny. And it was only until much, much later that I really understood what that exchange was about. And now I really appreciate it, and I'm happy that I had it because I got to see firsthand, you know, what this is all about. So I want to explain to you that exchange and explain to you why Hebrew is seen as controversial from the Satmar side of things, let's say, from the extreme religious side of things. And then I want to explain to you why Hebrew is controversial and difficult from the extreme liberal and left side of things as well. You'll see it's really a strange thing how controversial this is. Now, Rav Yecheskel Roth, just understand who this person is, other than a big tzaddik and a big Talmid Chacham, like I told you, right? But he's a person who lived here in Israel and was here in Israel during the war. Was born and lived over here. And when the Satmar Rebbe, Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum from Satmar, right? We mentioned this last week. He was one of the people that was saved. Mamish, hard to say, but Adolf Eichmann saved him, together with another 10,000 Jews on the Kastner train, right? There was this train of Jews that Eichmann sent from Hungary in order to show his goodwill that he was really willing to trade 1 million Jews. Right? You guys know what I'm talking about somewhere? Right? He was, so in that train of 10,000 Jews, the Satmar Rebbe got out, right? It's an amazing thing that's how the Satmar Rebbe was able to leave Hungary and continue Satmar Hasidus. He was one of the, you know, many, many, many Hasiduses just died in the war because the Rebbe and all the Hasidim just died, you know what I mean? So Satmar was one of the few that came through the war very, very strong. Now, but
how many Hasidus are there?
A lot.
Many, many, many. I don't know, many thousands. So the Satmar Rebbe came to America and he established Kiryas Yoel, right? That was the, you know, named after. I think it was named after him after he died. It was named after him, Yoel Teitelbaum. But he established, you know, Monroe and Muncie. These types of places became very, very big Satmar communities. And in the 70s, he realized that there was no big posek for his kehila. So it says in 1972, I looked him up on Wikipedia, in 1972, he got in touch with Rav Yecheskel Roth, who was a Satmar, you know, Rav here living in Israel, and again, that means that the Satmar Rebbe held that this person was the biggest posek that he could find in the world, you know, at least as far as Hasidim were concerned, and he brought him to America, but he came only on condition that he could come back for months every year to go to Meiron, and that's where he is now. So he lives in Bar Park. And, you know, like I said, and he's considered to be a very, very big dayan. He's no longer actually part of the Satmar officially community. I don't want to get into this whole thing, but there was a very big split in Satmar after the Rebbe died. There was like two different people that, you know, claimed to be the Rebbe, and he sided at the one that lost, so to speak. So he's officially now called the Kleisenberg, not Kleisenberg, that's wrong. Carlsberg, the Carlsberger Rebbe, that's what he's officially, the Carlsberger Rebbe. Wow. Anyway, I'll just tell you one other very interesting thing about him. I didn't know this until today also, I just saw this over here, in 2016, he had a very serious heart attack. In 2016, he had a serious heart attack, and he was brought to the hospital, and he was on life support, and there's something in halacha called a goses. A goses means a person that's mamash between life and death. right? Like barely alive. And the halacha is with the goseis, you're not allowed to touch them because anything you do might push them over the edge. You're not allowed to do anything, right? And he was in that state of being a goseis, and then he, Baruch Hashem, he came out of it and became healthy and well. Now, there's an event that happened in the Navi with Yechezkel and Navi and the bones, right? Was Yechezkel? No,
yeah.
Yechezkel and the bones, yeah?
Right,
so, right, that's what you said on the thing, right? The questions. So Yechezkel brought those bones back to life, and the Gemara discusses whether they needed to get married again, right? Did they need to do Kiddushin again on their wives, right? You had two people who were dead, and now they're brought back to life, right? So do they need to get married again, or is their original, you know, marriage good or not, right? There's a question that's discussed about those things, and it comes out that it's a suffix. So Rabbi Chesel Roth, when he got out of this coma, whatever, when he got out of this sickness, so he was choshesh for this, he remarried his wife. He did kedushim again on his wife because, you know, he was in that state of, pretty cool. I thought that's cool. Okay, anyway, so Satmar, like I mentioned to you last week, Satmar in particular, let's say of all of the groups of religious Jews that exist, Satmar are the most outspoken and well-known for their anti-Zionist stance. Right, their stance against the state of Israel, and like I explained to you on Yom HaTzmaut, where could that possibly be from? Because, like we said, there were many anti-religious people that were involved in establishing Israel. There are many anti-religious things that were involved in the establishment of the state of Israel, and there was a question as to how to relate to this. So, within the Frum world, there were basically, you know, a split. There were those who said, yes, we're against it, and we disagree with it, and we don't want to support it. However, we're here, and we need to try to, you know, work for our interests. So that's what, you know, let's say the Aguda does, or any of the Israeli parties that run in the elections, any of the religious parties. So, you know, they don't agree with all of the things, or with many of the things that were done in the establishment of the state of Israel. They don't agree with many of the things that go on over here. However, once they're here, they want to be a part of it, at least to try to see that the religious interests are taken care of. Whereas Satmar said, no, they said, no, we're not going to get involved in this at all. We hold it's completely pasul, it's treif, we're not going to get involved, and they hold it's the wrong thing to do to involve in, you know, themselves in politics and anything like that. So from their perspective, right, what is Ivrit? So we have to understand, what is Ivrit? What is the language that we speak here in Israel? And what is Lashon HaKodesh, right? And what did the Rambam write in? Okay, so this we have to really understand. There was never a language called, you know, Hebrew or Ivrit, right? There was the language of the Torah. Right, the language of the Torah was written in, and that the Nevi'im were written in, and that all the Mishnayis were written in, right? So we have a huge amount, a huge, vast vocabulary to pull on, right? Yeah, many of the Midrashim were written in Lashon HaKodesh, right? However, right, it stopped being the national language of the Jews when we went into Galus, right? When we went into Galus, so we went into Bavel, right, by the end of Bayis Sheni, and everybody was scattered, and we went out. So we know already that, they were already speaking Aramaic by then, right? The whole Gemara is written in, not in Lashon HaKodesh, it's written in Aramaic, which is a completely different language. There's some similarities and some overlaps, and, you know, but Aramaic is not, it's not Lashon HaKodesh, it's a different language, right? There's whole dictionaries in order to help people learn Gemara to translate back and forth between Aramaic and Lashon HaKodesh. And then what happened after that? After that, wherever the Jews went, they either wrote in Lashon HaKodesh, again, just using all the words that were written from the Mishnah and from Tanakh, and, you know, just using the vocabulary that we had for all of the years, they either wrote in that language, or they wrote and spoke in their own languages, or we developed our own, you know what a pidgin is, a pidgin language, it's like a fake language, or a quasi-language that develops amongst a certain cultural group, so Jewish people, wherever we were, we developed Yiddish, we developed Ladino, right, Ladino, does everybody know what that is? That's like the, yeah, that's like the Spanish form of Yiddish, right, we developed all these different, languages and ways of speaking. However, Lashon HaKodesh as a language was never ever spoken. Okay, this is very, very important to understand. From the time of Galus Bavel, right, from the time that the Jews left the Beis HaMikdash and we scattered around, there was no longer anybody anywhere in the world who was conversing in Lashon HaKodesh. It was the Lakshan, it was a language that was used for Torah. It was a language that was used for writing and for, you know, in Torah. However, there were no newspapers in Lashon HaKodesh. There were no books written in Lashon HaKodesh. You know, even when the printing press came out, there was nothing. There were books that were printed in the language where the people spoke, right? The Rambam wrote most of his stuff in Arabic. Right? It's amazing. You know that the Rambam was offered, right, when he was at that time period in his life, he was offered also to be the chief rav of England. Right? I don't know if you know about this. He was offered, he was sent a letter, they offered him to come to England, and for whatever reason he turned it down. Right? But I was just thinking that, can you imagine if he had gone to England, then yeah, it would be like the Canterbury Tales, you know what I mean? Like reading the Rambam would be like Chaucer, you know, like reading all the old, you guys know what I'm talking about? Yeah. Right? Old English, like Shakespeare, you know, yeah. It would be so cool to read, you know what I mean? Like the Rambam would have been written, but in the end it's Arabic. Right? So there was no such thing as Lashon HaKodesh. There was no such thing as a language that was spoken called Hebrew, Ivrit. And again, only in Torah writings were, you know, was this language used, because this was the language of the Torah. And to answer my own question, right, so the Rambam did not write in Ivrit or Hebrew. The Rambam wrote in Lashon HaKodesh, the same language that the Mishnah is written in, right? And it's got its whole structure and its whole grammar and its whole vocabulary. Okay. What happened is the following. What happened is, in the Haskalah years, right, the early 1800s, when the Haskalah began, the Enlightenment began, and people started to become much more cultured, and people started to become much more, you know, connected to their culture and to their history, so non-religious Haskalah Jews were looking to revitalize the Hebrew language, right? They want, because, you know, we didn't have any history of poetry in our language. We didn't have any history of great literature in our language, right? All the other languages have, you know, great literature and poems and all sorts of, you know, things that are a part of their history and their culture, right? And they're all very, very proud of it, right? All the American is very proud of their poets and their writers, and England and France and all of these people, right? And the Haskalah Jews felt very left out, right? Because the only culture that they could, you know, latch onto in this way were the cultures of their secular countries where they were living, right? So the Haskalah Jews started to promote the rebirth of the Hebrew language. And they started to use Hebrew in writing, in literature, and in poetry. And they started to use Hebrew in conversation, trying to, you know, revitalize the language. However, it's different from Lashon HaKodesh. Now, how, in what way? Obviously, there's a huge overlap, right? Obviously, most Israeli people, even if they never ever learned Torah before, they could probably open up a Chumash and, you know, get 70-80% of what's going on over there, right? Even though grammatically it's different and things are different, right? But what they started doing is adding new words to the vocabulary, right? There was a vocabulary that had not changed in hundreds and hundreds of years, right? There were no words to describe all sorts of things that had happened in the world. What's fascinating is one of the people that the Maskilim point to as one of the fathers of modern Ivrit is actually the Ramchal, which is fascinating, right? Because the Ramchal wrote in a very, very, not just poetic, but he wrote in a very articulate way, and he coined a lot of words. What does it mean to coin a word? It means to, like, to use a word in a new way, like, you know, to turn a verb into a noun, or to put together two words to mean something else that we, nothing is coming to mind right now, right? But a lot of, yeah, well, Shakespeare has thousands of words that he made up, thousands and thousands. Yeah, but the Ramchal was one of the first people in the more modern times, one of the first people to really write Lashon HaKodesh in a different style. And it's interesting that, you know, modern scholars today call the Ramchal the father of modern Ivrit, even though I think he would take exception to that, you know.
What books did he write?
Ramchal, he wrote, you know, tons, but his most famous starring with Derech Hashem and Das Tfunos and Mesilas Yesharim, and he wrote many, many books. He wrote a lot of poetry also, and he wrote plays, he wrote all sorts of things. Right, yeah, no, that's his. What? He wrote a whole play, Maisa Shimshon, he wrote a whole play about Shimshon fighting with his Yetzer Hara and the whole thing. You get this, it's online, you can see it online. Not see it, I'm saying you could read it. Okay, so now that Ivrit is starting to pick up, right, now people start to be more involved in it. And in 1881, right, a very, very well-known name of a person, right, named Ben Yehuda, very good. In 1881, he moved here from somewhere in Europe, I don't remember where he was from, somewhere in Eastern Europe, he moved to Israel, and he was the one who took it upon himself to really, you know, structure this language, to really flesh it out, to really, you know, go through it and, you know, formalize it and, like I said, make all sorts of new words. So he was the one who was responsible for a huge amount of the modern Israeli words that we have that never appeared before. You know, things like, you know, electricity, right? He Hashmal. Called electricity Chashmal. What is Chashmal? Anybody know what
it's
it is? It's an angel, right? It's an angel in the Navi that, like, is flashing and bright. So there are people who are against that. They don't. They feel it's a wrong thing to do, to take the name of a malach and to apply it to something, right? But, you know, that's the type of thing he did. Also, things like mail, like M-A-I-L, like there was no such thing as mail in the old days. So he made it doar, which is a something from the Mishnah. He was obviously a very, very brilliant man, and he went together and he, you know, put all these words together and all these things. Okay, you have it, maybe, okay, excuse me, you have it, but in the Mark absent, everybody's out here now. Go over it again. Thank you. Okay, so... one second. So in 1881, that's when Israel, like, are you allowed to do that? Maybe it's like, maybe it's not mutter for you to do. Maybe I have to do it. Maybe I have to do it. I'm like asking you to hurt your fans on the front.
Don't make her the bad guy.
I'm gonna be the big one. Okay, so okay. So what are you saying? What? Okay, so then maybe some of them will get marked here. Okay, so, no, this is too distracting. I can't do it. It's too distracting. Okay, so, so now you understand already, yeah, you can start to understand why there would be a negative attitude towards the language, right? Because Ivrit, its modern form of Ivrit, of Hebrew, what we call Hebrew, was something that was produced in the Haskalah, right? And it was made up by Maskilim, right? It was made up by people who were looking to, you know, change things. They were looking to not be like the old-fashioned Jew, right? They were anti-Yiddish, right? Why were they anti-Yiddish? Because Yiddish is like, that's the old-fashioned Jew, that's the shtetl Jew, that's the old way of being. You know, we are the new Jews, right? Those, you know, new proud European Jews, and part of their whole interest in shedding their old-fashioned ways, right, in addition to religiosity, which is a major, major point of contention, right, that they felt that religiosity was something that held Jewish development back, right? We showed that movie, and they were, you know, so, you know, how come we have no great literature, we have no great poets, we have no great anything? I mean, that's absurd to say. We have the greatest minds on the planet were in the Jewish nation throughout all of our history, right? But there was nothing for them to be proud of, right, without the Torah. So they developed this whole, you know, this whole thing, right? But again, it people who were realized what was going on took a very negative attitude towards it. And that's where this, you know, this response came from. So, you know, when I asked him, we'll speak in Ivrit, he was like, you know, that's like a slap in the face. Why would I want to speak in that, you know, messed up language that was made by anti-religious people who did whatever they could to, you know, delegitimize religion? And, you know, the whole language is made in order to cast off, you know, Yiddish, and cast off Ladino, and cast off these Jewish ways of identifying. So there's a very, very negative attitude towards the language on the right side of the spectrum. Okay, a couple questions, but then I want to go on. Yeah.
When was it made?
So, I'm saying it was developed over a long time. There's no like date that any language you could say it was made. I'm saying in the late 1800s is when Ben Yehuda came and made the first dictionary. You know, I don't remember what date it came out, but he came to Israel in the 1880s. So I'm assuming it was right around 1900 that the first, you know, formal structured, you know, dictionary with grammar and syntax and all of those things came out. But like every language is always being made. You know, it's constantly being changed and updated and everything. I'm just going to go across. Yeah.
Should the Sofer's just read Rock from Ramchal's work if they don't?
Say what?
The Sofer's just read Ramchal's work if they don't like his language?
No, Chas v'shalom. That's not, no. Chas v'shalom. No. Chas v'shalom. I'll make this very clear. Ramchal lived way, way, way before any of this. Ramchal lived in the 1600s, 1700s. He had nothing to do, early 1700s. He had nothing to do with, you know, the Haskalah or anything like that. It's just he wrote in a very poetic way. So people want to kind of like ascribe modern Ivrit style speaking to the Ramchal, but not nobody dislikes the Ramchal for that reason, that he wrote very articulately. Yep.
Where did the Ramchal live?
In Italy, and then Amsterdam, and then Tveria. He was died in Tveria. Yeah.
I heard at a point from one of my siblings that Israel is like a language. They handed out pamphlets at a certain point to like teach people the language in terms of words and diction. Like, is that, have you ever heard that before?
Could very well be. I'm saying in the beginning, and certainly in the beginning of the 1900s, again, there was no Hebrew language that was spoken. There was no Ivrit. So anybody here was speaking their language, which is either Arabic or Yiddish or, you know, Polish or whatever, you know, whatever, Hungarian, wherever they came from. They, in an effort to try to make it a national thing and to pull it together. So yes, it makes a lot of sense if they were trying to promote, you know what I mean, to promote it. You know, they could have picked any language to be the national. They could have made it English, right? But they
wanted.
So,
one of the intentions that Ivrit's like a bastardization of the Kaddish, is that
I don't think the issue is not so much that they tinkered with the, you know, with the grammar and they don't have the, you know, I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is that it's a product of a modern wanting to move away from the old-fashioned ways, and that's not our thing. We are old-fashioned when it comes to Torah, right? The old ways are the right ways, right? When it comes to Torah and
Hebrew.
So,
don't speak Hebrew?
They don't speak Hebrew, exactly. They speak
Yiddish.
They speak Yiddish or the Bashna Kodesh.
Like, then how do they communicate to people who are not Satmar?
Because
maybe they learn it like a person would learn, you know, Spanish in order to interact with people, like, just like English, right? Saying you, but it's not. They don't. It's not a language that
they speak. Well, they speak Yiddish or whatever language they're from,
they don't live here. Not Summer's not here.
Sure,
not in big numbers, not in large numbers.
Yeah, against, like, they're not, well, they're against, you know, being a part of it, and you know, but to live here physically, there are people living here for forever. They're not going to not live here just because there's a Jewish government. Although some people would. Yeah, Sapir, your hand was up for a while. Answer. Yeah.
Oh no, you answered.
I answered. Psychic. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
We're saying like they were the old fashioned. I got that they were trying to move away from the old fashioned. What's so the old fashioned ways of speaking Yiddish and Latino? Those are just products of being in another environment and getting
right. The diaspora Jew. That's exactly what they wanted to get rid of.
It's because they were in the environment. They had to mesh it with the other languages. So what makes that so great? It's not like it was Lashon HaKodesh, and then they wanted to move away from Lashon HaKodesh and make their own thing called Hebrew. Anyway, it's Yiddish is similar to German. It's not. It doesn't. What
Yiddish
is
literally called Jewish. That's the name of the language.
Right.
It's Jewish.
It is a Jewish way of speaking, and to lump that together with. Again, if all they wanted to do was change the language, that wouldn't have been an issue, right? But the language was one among many, you know, halacha and Torah and God and, you know, many other things being on that list of things that they were trying to cut themselves off from, right? So I agree with you. If it would just be the language, let's say you had a group of really fluent, dedicated Torah Jews that are just trying to be able to communicate, you know, universally, so they're going to come up with a language. I don't think that would be controversial or upsetting. But in the context of cutting out all the things that they were looking to cut out, so they made a stand about all of them, right? Including the language. Right? So, but you know what I'm saying? It's representative
of something else. So languages by themselves, it's not like it was Lashon HaKodesh anyway, so it's the languages themselves are just languages and
they right. But it's what it represents. I know, but their point in cutting it off is what it represents, and their point in wanting to keep it is what it represents. That's the idea, right? Not so much like the words they're using, but the concept of the old Jew and the new Jew, whatever is there, you know. Yeah. No? Okay. So that's on the right side of things, okay? On the right wing side of things, right? And when it comes to very, very religious or, you know, Satmar or that type of thing, why they find Ivrit to be you know, wrong and offensive. However, on the far, far left, right, both in Israel and abroad, there is a completely opposite, a different, not opposite, just completely different major objection to the Hebrew language. Can anybody try to think what it is? It's really hard to kind of reach, but it's out there.
It sets us apart as like a distinct, I don't know, like I'd have an issue with
that. Is that true to the Hebrew language?
mm-hmm. is that you take holy words from
the Shulchan. No. That's from the, that's like the Torah.
Is there an issue that it's too Jewish? The opposite end.
Whoa.
Okay, so what they say is as follows. Okay, you gotta listen to this. Okay, and I alluded to this on Purim. I alluded to this on Purim. Okay.
We all rack our memories.
How do you remember that?
I said to you on Purim, you know, nowadays, the biggest avera that you can do is cultural appropriation, right? Cultural appropriation is seen to be like, you know, rishus, an evil thing to do, you know, to try to adopt another culture's identity and take on, you know, another culture's identity and, you know, try to adopt it as your own. And I'm gonna frame this for you. I'm running out of time, but I want to frame this for you the way I wanted to. So there was just this week, yesterday, 2 days ago, a Muslim member of Congress. This woman, Rashida Tlaib. There's only a few. I said I was gonna talk about it here in the class. So she was in an interview or something. And in this interview, she, you know, was, I don't know how it came up, but she was asked to address the Holocaust or something. And she said, you know, she takes comfort in knowing that it was her people who, you know, provided the Jews with a safe harbor, you know, after the war. You know, after the Jews had been persecuted. I don't have my phone. I don't have my phone. I would read it to you. After the Jews had been persecuted, if you could find it. Yeah, try to find it.
What's her name?
Rashida Tlaib. Holocaust, it'll come up like probably right away. Yep. That she said that, you know, the Jews had been persecuted so terribly and suffered so tragically, you know, throughout all of Europe, that she took comfort in knowing, you know, that it was her people who provided the Jews with their safe haven. She just only wishes that it could have been done, you know, in a nicer way and without, you know, robbing them of their lands and their livelihoods and their dignity and their lives. This is what she said. Is what she said.
It's a great thing we did, but it cost us our lives.
So, first of all, does everybody understand what she's saying?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
She's saying that, like, you know, basically the Nebuch, those Jews after the war, were refugees, and, you know, it's only the Palestinians who took them in, right? And they'll welcome them over here. That's an absurd thing to say, right? It's an absurd thing to say, however, you know, she said it. And she means it, and what, you know,
it's hard to find her words because all they have is reactions to it.
No, there's a quote.
We Palestinians provided a safe haven for Jews. That's like the big.
No, I know, but there's a whole. It's not so long. It's like a small paragraph. But she says she takes comfort. Look up the word comfort. Holocaust comfort.
That's also the one that's misquoted on. People like cut it off after that one.
After what?
After we take comfort in the hall, like what people.
Yeah, okay, that sounds stupid. That's not, you know, it's people. Looking at things in context, right? But this is in the context. This is what she did. Anyway, so but the issue with this is, you know, is that, you know, there's a lot of.
It provides her with a calming feeling.
A calming feeling. Okay, I'm sorry. Not comfort. I apologize. A calming feeling. Right, to know that those 6 million Jews are not coming to Israel. You got it? Okay, thank you. Okay. Tlaib, yeah. Okay, she was on a podcast called Skullduggery.
What the hell?
Okay.
Real official.
In an episode titled From Rashida with Love. Okay. There's always kind of a calming feeling I tell folks. There's always kind of a calming feeling I tell folks when I think of the Holocaust and the tragedy of the Holocaust and the fact that it was my ancestors, Palestinians, who lost their land and some lost their lives, their livelihood, their human dignity, their existence in many ways have been wiped out, and some people's passports. And just all of it was in the name of trying to create a safe haven for Jews post the Holocaust, post the tragedy and the horrific persecution of Jews across the world at that time. And I love the fact that it was my ancestors that provided that, right, in many ways, but they did it in a way that took their human dignity away and it was forced on them. Okay.
She's just like,
So this person is very good. Okay. There are so many historical inaccuracies in this one statement that it's difficult to even know where to start. Right? But to highlight a few. Okay, so then obviously it's an absurd thing. It's mamish an absurd thing. The mamish absurd. And but what's also absurd is that the leader of the Palestinians at that time was this guy named al-Husseini. Whatever, Mamish, Rasha Marusha, he's the one person, Mamash. If there was one person who is responsible for the whole thing, it's him. Because if he would have just been okay with the offers that he was given, and if he would have just been told the people to be okay with it, there would Mamish not be a Palestinian problem. Right? But instead, he was so sure that Israel was going to be wiped out, and he was so sure that we were not going to last, that he went all in against us. And this is the guy who met with Hitler, right? It's a famous thing that he met Mamish to Berlin during the war. There's a picture of him sitting there, this Muslim guy with his hat and his beard, sitting there with Adolf Hitler. Mamish, Rasha Marusha, so to say anything like this is absurd. However, the problem is that this is what we call historical revisionism, right? You're changing history in order to fit your narrative. Right? The narrative being that the Palestinians were here forever, and we came in and pushed them out, and they're the ones who suffered for us. Right? So that's their narrative. And while there's a grain of truth to it, right, there is such a dynamic, something along those lines that happened. Right? However, the way it's distorted and the way that it's presented, is totally outrageous and totally wrong. Okay. So what does this have to do with Israel? People
he
on the
that
left.
Up what you just said.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah. So what's the guy's name? What's his name?
Amin
al-Husayani. Al-Husayni. Okay, yeah. Mamish, Rasha Marusha, Mamish, evil man. And he's seen as like a hero to the Palestinians. I think, from what I understand, that's one of the we look up to Golda Meir and the great early leaders of the Israel. So he's one of the great early leaders of the Palestinian people, right? This guy. Okay. Anyway, so what the left doesn't like about Hebrew is they think it's like a dirty trick on the part of the Jews to like pretend that we belong here. That's what they say, right? You hear this? Yeah, by making up and trying to revive our old, first of all, they consider it to be the same as the Torah, right? In other words, that's they don't understand this or care that it's different. They consider it to be the same language as the Torah. And they're saying that the fact, which it is from the outside, it basically is, but they're saying the fact that the Jews have invented, they're culturally appropriating themselves, right? That's what they say. We're trying to make up this ancient language and revitalize it to pretend that we really have roots over here, right? When everybody knows we don't, and we only came here as European, colonialists after the war, right? So, the using Ivrit is seen by them as an anti-Palestinian, not propaganda, but maneuver, right? Trying to make believe that we have real long established roots over here by making believe that we speak the language that was spoken by our ancient ancestors, right? When in fact we have nothing to do with them, and there's no connection, and so on the very far left, and there's Israelis that say this. Israelis also, Israeli scholars and whatever that are of this opinion, right? There's no more nobody's a bigger anti-Semite than the really really left Israelis. Jesus. Right? It's crazy. And it's so sad because they make themselves very available for interviews and for podcasts and all these things, and so every anti-Semitic Al Jazeera anything, they always have their Israeli Jew there who's willing to go on and say all of these types of things, right? Which is very very upsetting, obviously, right? But this is the view that that they feel that is it's a form of cultural appropriation that we're trying to in a sneaky way, take back, this has always been an Arabic-speaking land. This is, all the people that lived here, even the Jews that lived here spoke Arabic, which is true. That's absolutely true. This is an Arab land. And to try to make up some language to try to strengthen your claim to it so everybody sees through your Zionist propaganda, right? That's what they say. So that's why the Hebrew language is controversial on the left, on the right. Okay. Shalom.
Oh, that was great.
Thank you.
Should we have a speaker on right now, right?
Yeah.
Did somebody record that? Somebody asked
that? Yeah.
What did your parents do?